The Guardian.
Hello, and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Paul McInnes. I'm sitting in for Jason Solomons this week as he's away on his holidays, lucky man. And jeepers, have we got a packed show for you today. We talked to Danny Houston, son of John and star of the new Orson Welles biopic, Fade to Black, about how it felt to play such an iconic character.
It was a very daunting task. Just the idea of playing somebody of Orson Welles' weight and importance in cinema was very daunting.
We'll also be discussing why successful music directors are venturing across to mainstream filmmaking when Garth Jennings of Hammer and Tongs and Casper Llewellyn Smith join me in the studio. Plus, we'll have a report from South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. But first, the current wave of British comic horror films has a new addition this week with a release of The Cottage, written and directed by Paul Andrew Williams and starring Jennifer Ellison, yes, her out of Brookside, Andy Serkis, yes, the man who played both Gollum and King Kong, and Reese Shearsmith, yes, former resident of Royston Vasey and part of the League of Gentlemen. It's fair to say that The Cottage is in the vein of films like Shaun of the Dead and Severance. It's story based on two bickering brothers who kidnap a gangster heiress and whisk her away to the countryside, only for things to start going rather gruesomely wrong.
Now look, you are our hostage, and if you don't give us a hard time, you will be fine and looked after. However, if you cross us, I will break your fingers. Now, I'm going to be speaking to your father, so will you please be quiet? Can I speak to Arnie, please? This is you, okay? It doesn't matter who I am. Yes, I'm with... No, you can speak to her in a second. No, the amount is 100,000. We would like you to put the money in a bag and give it to your son. He is to drive alone to Fleet Services on the M3 and wait next to the men's toilets. Make sure you don't send no one else. Terrible double negative, doesn't make sense. If anything goes wrong or someone is with him, your stepdaughter is a dead girl. You've got 2 hours.
That is Reese Shearsmith playing Peter in The Cottage. Reese spends a large part of the film being battered around, accruing some impressive injuries. I spoke to him earlier today and asked him about the process he had to go through to be made up in that kind of way.
Well, it was all the pre-planning was I had the whole head cast, and then I had various parts of my body cast as well, because it's not just my face that gets beaten up. Every day for 6 weeks I had a big kind of black eye added onto the top of my eyelid, and my nose attachment was added in, and I had stuff that clipped into my mouth to make my face stick out one side, and it did become kind of, you know, I wanted to just tear it off in the end. It became quite horrible because it was all shot at night as well, which was also kind of an extra discomfort, because it's weird to be working through the twilight hours and going back to the hotel room when everyone's...
As well as all the injuries you sustain, you have an absolutely terrible haircut in the film.
I know.
Tell me about the tonsure.
Yeah, that was nightmarish. I mean, Paul wanted the character to be balding, and I knew that it would be a tight schedule, so I said I would shave my head to save us the time in the morning, which would have been taken up with putting on a bald cap.
You did it yourself.
So, no, I didn't do it. The makeup ladies shaved off all the front of my hairline, really far back. It was horrible. And then this big monk patch out the back.
I wonder, after making Little Gentleman, after making this film, you have any idea of what you think makes a successful comic horror movie work?
Yeah, I mean, that is it's a really hard balance to get right. There's very few, I think, that do it very well. I think American Werewolf in London is probably the best one. They're two very different emotions in one way, but in another way they're quite similar in the way that in what they do to the person or the body watching it, you know, because you get that kind of relief, that catharsis that happens when you have a jump, and then you kind of laugh in relief that it's not you that's having your head chopped off.
No, I thought there was one interesting bit in the film where the proximity is really obvious, and that somebody gets an axe shoved into their leg in a particularly horrific way.
Yeah.
And then the very next thing, somebody stands on a rake in kind of time-honoured comic tradition.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that's exactly the kind of... That says it all, really, doesn't it? It's the juxtaposition of those exact two things, a clownish thing and a horrific kind of version of it.
What's coming up for you now that The Cottage is put to bed?
Well, Steve Pemberton and I are from The League. We've together written a new series for BBC Two, which has been commissioned, and we're writing that now, and we start filming in September, and that's on in January.
And
so it's a very similar, it's not a League of Gentlemen project, because there's only two of us, but it is very similar sensibility, you know, because it's me and Steve doing it, and there's a lot of the same. I think if you like League, you'll probably like this. It's quite dark.
That was Rhys Shearsmith. Cillian Fox of The Observer joins me in the studio to discuss this week's releases, of which The Cottage is one. Hello, Cillian.
Hi, Bob.
Are you well?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, good. Now, we saw this film together last week, and we hugged each other close for comfort on a number of occasions, but I'm not going to elaborate why. Did you find this film funny and scary?
I'm afraid I found it neither funny nor especially scary. It's pretty awful in parts.
What did you make of the lead characters, Shearsmith and Serkis?
Well, there's Williams is obviously trying to inject a bit of humour into the film. There's lots of parping kind of trumpet scores and things, but I found. Weirdly, Shearsmith didn't quite deliver the whole comedy thing. He's great in The League of Gentlemen, but I felt he was a little out of his depth here, perhaps.
But Circus, I think
Circus is great.
Yeah, yeah. He did show why he's worth the money. He does manage to come across as a suitably peeved and weighed upon individual who's looking for his due and will never quite get it.
He's the one strong suit in this film, I thought.
On to our second release this week, Mr. Lonely. Directed by indie impresario Harmony Korine, this comedy follows the Michael Jackson impersonating busker, played by Diego Luna, from Paris to London to remote Scotland, where he hopes to join a community of doppelgangers that includes versions of the Pope, the Queen, and Charlie Chaplin. Together, these lost souls hatch a scheme to stage, if not the greatest show on earth, then surely the most peculiar.
How long have you been Michael?
I guess I was born this way. So how long have you been married?
Since I first got my boobs.
So, Cillian, does this do a decent impersonation of a good movie?
People seem to either love or hate Harmony Korine's stuff, and I'm somewhere in the middle on this film. It's got a very sort of distinctive feel to it, I thought, and there's some wonderful scenes. There's some really visually impressive parts of the film, particularly Werner Herzog and his flying nuns.
Does it deliver what it promises in terms of characterization, or is I worry with certainly going back to some of his earlier stuff like Gummo, it was very episodic and quite shallow. It looked good, but once you kind of sat down and thought about it, there wasn't much beneath. Is that anywhere to hear?
I think, unfortunately, yeah, the whole impersonator conceit seems to run a little dry after a while. I think they managed to irritate me more than entertain me throughout most of the movie, particularly Diego Luna in the main part.
Okay, thank you very much, Cillian. Our final film this week is Redacted, a high-def, shaky-cam fakeumentary from Brian De Palma, which, and I quote, visually documents imagined events before, during, and after a 2006 rape and murder in Samarra.
How about a war story?
Really want to hear a war story?
No,
absolutely.
All right, here's a war story for you.
So I joined up to get the money for college and a better chance at film school. Oh, I mean, I'm going to be a combat vet, for Christ's sakes, right?
You must stay.
If you die in this war, I'll get your videos, your camera, and your girlfriend's phone.
Now, Cillian, the quote I read out just before that clip there runs at the beginning of the film, and I wonder whether it doesn't go right to the heart of this movie. Talking about visually documenting imagined events leaves it potentially in a limbo in between documentary and fiction. Did you find it worked?
I didn't think it hit hard enough. I mean, there's some very visceral and shocking and graphic scenes, but somehow the medium, though ambitious it was to splice all these different formats together, sort of camcorder footage and documentaries and YouTube videos and all that, just kept you at a remove from I thought, what the heart of the message was for this one.
What did you think of the acting therein?
Well, perhaps that was part of the reason why I felt slightly removed from the film. In order to do something like that, you've got to have very, very convincing people playing the parts. And I sense he's used a lot of amateur people who haven't done film work before on this, which can go either way. But in this case, it just seemed a little stagey to me in quite a lot of parts.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of ham and corn going around.
There's a lot of ham.
Almost enough to make a tasty omelette. Okie doke. And now to Austin, Texas, an oasis of creativity and organically grown whole food in the state of the pickup truck and outsized barbecue. Every year since 1987, Austin has played host to the South by Southwest Festival. Initially a music industry showcase for bands, it has since blossomed to include a film festival that is rapidly gaining respect as one of the heavyweight new contenders in the movie world, particularly since the highly successful premiere of Knocked Up there last year. I'm off there myself this week for the music festival. That's my day job, you see. But Film Weekly had the presence of mind to send Steve Rose there for the duration of the film end. And here's his report.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to South by Southwest 2008.
This is Steve Rose. I'm in the Austin Convention Center in the middle of Austin, Texas. I'm here for the South by Southwest Film Festival, as are hundreds of other people who you can hear milling around in the background. They're either queuing for their passes or typing furiously into laptops. Some are even playing with Lego over in the corner there. The first person I'm looking for is Matt Dentler, who is the festival producer, which means he's the person who's put the program together. Let's go and track him down and see what he's got to say.
You know, I think what's really great about South by Southwest is that there's a real community atmosphere. You know, there isn't sort of a hierarchy of industry and film fans and filmmakers. I think everyone is kind of on the same playing field. So it's great. Plus, you know, we have some of the best audiences in the world, some of the best theaters you'll ever find. It's just a great experience.
Do you look for a particular type of film to bring to South by Southwest?
As we're programming, we try to make sure that we're always thinking about the audience and the audience experience and how is this film going to play in front of a room full of strangers. I think too often it's easy to get sidetracked and only, you know, program with your own taste in mind, but you have to, you know, you have to think about film as an audience experience because that's what a festival's all about. So, you know, I mean, we try to program a lot of films that are fun, light, and even if they're somewhat more serious or dark, they still have a very kind of unique, vibrant thread about them.
Now, for those not familiar with the festival, could you possibly name a couple of films that have sort of broken into the mainstream that have via South by Southwest in recent years, please?
Yeah. Last year, I think one of our big success stories was the film Knocked Up, Judd Apatow's film, which had never really been seen before. And I had a chance to watch it several months before the festival, loved it, thought it was hilarious, so I brought it to the festival. In addition, you know, a lot of the smaller films also tend to get a lot of, you know, attention. There's, you know, this film called Hannah Takes the Stairs that has done fairly well internationally, actually, on the international circuit. It's played, you know, the London Film Festival and Stockholm and a few others. And it's, you know, part of this movement called Mumblecore that's kind of a joke.
Okay, so I'm standing here outside the Alamo Ritz in downtown Austin, and I've met a bunch of people who I think can tell me the definition of mumblecore.
20-somethings, subject matter, relationships, sex, dating, handheld camera work.
I think that what people are defining as mumblecore is actually people are just throwing this tag on it because it's easy to market it. It's like saying something's a horror film or something's a red state or a blue state. Like, it's just an easy way to package something up and sell it. And, you know, while that idea was around to describe an artistic atmosphere these films were going for, it's more about allowing distributors to say, here's the newest mumblecore project.
Okay, that's Steve Rose, and you can catch up with all his reports and reviews in text form on film.guardian.co.uk across this week. Now, Killian, they're just talking there at the end of the report, obviously, about mumblecore and whether it exists or not. Is it a made-up name for a made-up thing?
Well, to be honest, I think my suspicion is that mumblecore is a term applied to any sort of low-budget indie film with shaky production values. I don't know if it's a...
If you're doing it right or not. Yes, I think you might not be the only person to share that suspicion. Anyway, thanks so much to Killian Fox of The Observer for coming in today. Take care, young man.
Thank you very much, Paul.
There was once a time when ad directors were the ones who dreamt of crossing over and putting their work out on the big screen. But in recent years, it's been the men, and it's mostly men, behind music videos who've been making their moves towards Hollywood. Jonathan Glazer made his name directing videos for Radiohead, Massive Attack, Blur and Jamiroquai before making Sexy Beast and Birth. The prolific Michel Gondry gained attention with a series of surreal promos for artists including Bjork, Daft Punk and the White Stripes before directing The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and Be Kind Rewind, which is on release right now. Then there's Spike Jonze, who made celebrated promos for the Beastie Boys and Fatboy Slim before producing similarly eye-catching material in the shape of Being John Malkovich and Adaptation. Joining me in the studio today to talk about the points where film and music meet are Garth Jennings and Casper Llewellyn Smith. Garth Jennings is one half of Hammer and Tongs, the director of the forthcoming film Son of Rambo, as well as being the man responsible for numerous music videos for bands including Pulp, REM, Blur and more. Casper is the editor of the Observer Music Monthly. Hello to both.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hello. Oh,
it's good to hear people so upbeat in the studio. Garth, can I start with you?
Yeah.
Is it a natural progression to move from music video direction to full-size feature films?
Well, it felt natural to us. I don't know if it really is for everyone else, but we'd always wanted to make films. I mean, as long as I can remember, I've wanted to make films. And certainly making music videos was a brilliant way of sort of learning how to just shoot stuff and how films work and how you film things and get them made and tell little stories. And then as far as actually making that leap from 3 minutes to 90 minutes, it was just a case of learning how to write, which took years, but it paid off in the end. It worked out.
Oh, yeah. I see. So it's the writing rather than the technical skills of actually making it up is pretty much the same.
Well, the funny thing was, everyone was telling us, oh, it's very different, Garth. You won't be able to do the things you used to do in music videos in films. You know, you won't be able to bring the same people, you'll need different people and loads more stuff. And actually what we realised was we'd spent so long making music videos and we'd built up this family and this really tight-knit crew of people that work with us. And they're brilliant at doing everything. Mm-hmm. And it was only really the length of the thing that was different. And so with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is our first film, we had lots of things we didn't need, even though it came out great and we were really pleased with it. When we came to do Son of Rambo, I was able to apply the rules and things we'd learned by doing music videos. And it came out great.
Can I ask you something about that? Sorry, Paul. Which do you feel you've got more control over? I mean, with pop stars, is it a case of following their every whim and you're told what to do as a music video director?
I think, on the whole, we've been very lucky because the sort of ideas we would pitch to bands were so obscure that if they bought into it, they were sort of buying into it. You know, it wasn't like we were being dictated in any way. If you say to Blur, OK, we're going to do a story about a milk carton and he's going to go looking for you and then you're going to be in it for about 30 seconds. If they like that idea, there's not really much room for, you know, them to sort of take over. Not that we're trying to count them out by any means. We're huge fans of all the artists we work with. But yeah, it was one of those things where we always ended up having really rather pleasant experiences with most bands because they were just amused to see what on earth it was we were going to make for them.
Is that a control you've been able to keep moving into feature films?
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's, in a way, it's just with Hitchhikers, it was a pitch that we did that was, we just figured this would be the best way to do it. And they liked that. So we got on to do it that way. And they left us alone to do the whole film.
Casper, when you watch a film, can you tell if it's been directed by a music video director?
I don't think so, because I think, as you say, so many people have had that training now. And equally, you know, some of the people you mentioned have also worked in advertising. Michelle Gondry made a really famous Levi's commercial as well. And you don't recognise him as a music director or a film, a commercials director necessarily. On the other hand, I suppose, you know, there's people with very distinct visual styles and you see that replicated on the big screen. You think of someone like Anton Corbijn, and you see the Joy Division film and you think, oh, yeah, well, that looks like his photos and that looks like a lot of the videos he's shot before. And, you know, straight away, it's Anton Corbijn. I don't think you plug him as a video director, but you know it's him, all right.
Would you say that the aesthetic aspect of filmmaking is more pronounced when you're making a music video because you've only got that short amount of time to make an impact and no dialogue, for example?
I guess so. I think you are indulged in terms of how you'd like to tell your story or whatever it is you're doing in your video. And you have to be more inventive. I suppose once you've done that for a while, you start to learn things that you'd really like to expand upon. Mm-hmm. When you watch a Michel Gondry film, you can see all those things he sort of noodled about with over the years coming to life in a big movie. There's certainly things we've toyed around with. I can't think off the top of my head, but I feel like a lot of the things we've learned along the way, we've been able to apply to films.
Yeah.
Certainly, when you've got people like McGee, who've got a really obvious kind of like music video style, the real kind of flashy cutting thing, then you really can see it. But it sort of works for a film like Charlie's Angels, I suppose. You know, it's sort of, that's the kind of thing you want.
Well, especially Full Throttle, I think it was, feels like a 90-minute music video.
Yeah, it is a downhill, you know, and just cut. Yeah.
Well, I suppose that's the thing I was going to say. I mean, increasingly films just feel like they're extended music videos, and I guess that starts with who? Sort of Scorsese or someone introducing a contemporary soundtrack into cinema, yeah, and it not being something that's score, but you use pop songs.
Yeah, that's true. I haven't really made it, even though we've got lots of 80s sort of pop music in our recent film, we've never actually done anything to the music yet. But it's very tempting because you're trained in, you know, fitting everything to the music, a great bit for the chorus. And there's something delightful about just putting picture to music. It's very, very satisfying as a process. But I haven't really been able to do that properly yet.
But I wonder whether if as the talent migrates to the big screen, whether music videos might be losing their prestige, whether it might be an art form that's had its day, its heyday in the 80s. I mean, Casper, do you ever sit at home and watch MTV Bass of a weeknight?
I don't actually. I really don't. And it's, you know, but that's might be simply because I'm quite old. I mean, I think it's difficult in this conversation if you don't remember that aspect of it. And that when we talk about Michael Jackson and Thriller, well, that's just because everyone's of a certain age and they get nostalgic about it inevitably. Where I do watch them, I think, is on YouTube increasingly.
Can they make an impact still?
Well, the amazing thing, I've just had a really bizarre experience in that when we came back from doing the film, we tried to do music videos again, and the budget's all a lot smaller. Really, really. And so but that's fine because, you know, we would only end up doing things for bands we sort of loved anyway. And we just did this Cheap as Chips video for a band called Vampire Weekend.
Oh!
And no, it was amazing.
No, we had them on the music podcast.
We've had them on here. Yeah. They're fantastic. And that's why we did it. We really like them. And we made this for almost nothing. It's just one take on video, boom, done. Finished by 3 o'clock and everyone goes home. That's had something like 1.5 million hits on YouTube now.
Is this the A-Punk?
A-Punk, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a bit mitchy as well, isn't it?
No, but that's which is fascinating to me because it's sort of like that was just a quick, simple thing and it was so much fun to do. And it was just like it used to be when we first started.
Yeah.
And I suppose that aesthetic is more a kind of YouTube aesthetic of it feeling quite DIY and something that they could have shot for themselves at home.
Absolutely.
Rather than saying, right, we need, you know, 25 chickens in this shot and we need to hire the Eiffel Tower for it.
It's
as well.
True.
Now, I think you've kind of hit upon it there, Garth, because I was going to ask you whether you still had an interest in making music videos, and obviously you do.
Yeah.
But is it something that actually is for a filmmaker, that option of a career will become more narrow, more marginalised as the budgets continue to be
That's
reduced?
That's a good point. I don't really know for sure, but I certainly know for us, we wouldn't be able to keep going as a company, or you know, we'd have to keep our other jobs going like we used to do when we first left college.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you can make them that cheaply, then you should be all right. You know, it seems like it's really wide open for people to come up with good ideas. I think that's the trick, is coming up with something that works.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Garth Jennings, Casper Llewellyn-Smith, joining me here today. Son of John and half-brother of Angelica, Danny Houston belongs to one of cinema's most illustrious dynasties. Over recent years, however, he has carved out a niche for himself with a series of compelling performances in films including Ivan's Ecstasy, The Aviator and Children of Men. He is now filling the ample suit of Orson Welles in the biopic Fade to Black, directed by Oliver Parker, who made his name with Othello in 1995. Zan Brooks, editor of guardian.co.uk/film, talked to him earlier this week and asked the natural question, wasn't it just a bit daunting to play the man responsible for Citizen Kane?
I believe Marlene Dietrich said that one should cross oneself before even mentioning Orson's name.
Mm.
I feel somewhat similar to that. It was a very daunting task. Just the idea of playing somebody of Orson Welles' weight and importance in cinema was very daunting. What helped me was the sort of maverick spirit and the smoke and mirrors, the sort of magician quality that he had, that also my father had at times, where they lived up to their own mythology in a way. They played with their mythology. They tinkered with it, like magicians do. And they were magicians in their own right. They loved the illusion of cinema and played with that, and played into their legendary mythological giant-like quality that seemed to make an impression on the way that people interpreted who they were.
You actually met Orson Welles at one stage, I believe, on the set of his film The Other Side of the Wind.
Yes, I did. I met Orson Welles with my father. They had great respect for each other. And The Other Side of the Wind, I was lucky enough to see some of the footage. It's quite incredible. My father plays this sort of director who's slightly gay and homophobic, and Peter Bogdanovich is in it. He uses lots of different types of film and 60 millimeter mixed with 35 millimeter, and and it's a wonderful tapestry of odd, strange, and but very strong imagery.
Do you see Orson Welles as a sort of largely tragic figure? I mean, he had this kind of brilliant promise early on, and then it all kind of seeped away over the next sort of five decades, really.
Yes, I do. I believe that in Fade to Black we touch upon that, but we don't really go into it because we're basically telling the story of a younger Welles. I think at times it's slightly foreboding, but we're really, in a way, celebrating the younger Welles and his zest and zeal for solving crime stories and his great wit and desire to sort of weave a yarn and to play the audience. Was I think what we're dealing with in Fade to Black, rather than the sort of tragic voiceovers that he did later in life, which were bitter and tragic.
I mean, both Welles and your father are sort of seen now as kind of symbols of an older tradition of directors, a slight sort of daredevil, slightly disreputable. Is there a sort of still a place for those characters in the industry today, do you think?
Oh, I believe there is. One could say that they're men that were made of a different cloth, but I believe the men exist, but the times have changed. I mean, the big difference between Welles and my father, I suppose, is that my father was able to play the system and keep working for a long time, where Welles, with you know, the great success of Citizen Kane, seemed to kind of go downwards from that point on, where my father was able, in a sort of poker-like manner, deliver film after film. I remember my father, when he used to deliver a cut, he would say, "You know, gentlemen, this is my cut," and he'd be gone. Where Welles would stay in the ring and fight
and get beaten up,
and get beaten up. I think some of that is possibly is a romantic view that we have imposed upon him. A lot of it was just, I think, bad luck. He got himself involved in circumstances that were just very tricky, and he was so independently minded that he just kept going.
That was Sam Brooks talking to Danny Houston. I'm afraid that's it for Film Weekly this week. Thanks to my studio guests, Garth Jennings, Casper Llewellyn-Smith, and Killian Fox. Jason Solomons will be back in the hot seat next week, tanned, relaxed, and quite possibly clutching a straw donkey. But for me, Paul McInnes, thanks for listening and happy viewing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.